indeed found to be illegal by the judicial council. As an FYI, even if it weren't, the injunction still would have been legitimate, but I'm simply pointing that out. If anyone in this room thinks that Justice Unterhalter has an agenda against the Graduate Assembly, perhaps not to pass, and was colluding or doing other things to make sure that it didn't pass, to make sure the Graduate Assembly did not get their autonomy, I would submit to you this. That's unsubstantiated. There is no evidence to support that. I'd like to turn your attention to the Judicial Rules of Procedure 5.1.2. In 5.1.2, and by the way, Title 21 requires the Senate to follow the JRPs in the removal hearing, so we are bound by the JRPs in this hearing. In 5.1.2, it explicitly says that the defendant is innocent until proven guilty. In 5.1.2, they then give three kinds of criteria that must be met in order to move from the presumed innocence to guilt. One such criteria is factual allegations supported by clear and convincing evidence. There is no clear and convincing evidence saying that Jessica Unterhalter acted more so on the basis of trying to hold back or subjugate the Graduate Assembly and not uphold the rules. Not only that, this is also just an FYI, but 2 years ago, Jessica Unterhalter, as a member of the Judicial Council, actually ruled that the Graduate Assembly maintained financial autonomy. That was in one of the decisions. She wrote the decision in that case. So not only is there not clear and convincing evidence supporting that, there's actually evidence supporting the opposite. Jessica Unterhalter has no agenda against the Graduate Assembly. That makes no sense. That's unsubstantiated. And in 5.1.2 of the JRP, that's a clear requirement in order to find her guilty. Okay. That's the judicial rules of procedure. Sorry. So I told the president. Is the article? Close hearing. Okay. So again, to remind you, what's going on with the first argument I'm making? So equal protection. The Judicial Council found it submitted as evidence. You'll see the text of the injunction. You'll see the text of the decision also. But the text was illegal. Equal protection of the students would have been violated had
Justice. I'm going to interrupt you. Okay, can we get the room to quiet again? And especially justices, please pay attention. If you have questions or I love this later, please pay attention to your guests that are interrupting. Get out and leave. Go ahead.
Had Justice Unterhalter, the council unanimously decided to place the injunction because they feared irreparable harm would have ensued, council actually ended up being right, considering that the text of the referenda were found to be illegal. But had Justice Unterhalter, upon seeing that the executive order was released, not stayed the executive order with an emergency preliminary injunction, then the students themselves would have been unduly swayed and equal protection for their rights that nobody's even considering here would have been violated. And they would have been violated in favor of President Leibovich. That's a violation of equal protection. What Justice Unterhalter did was absolutely necessary in order to uphold equal protection. Okay. I want to clarify something else. Some senators have asked some good questions regarding accessibility of the Judicial Council. How accessible are these members? The form in which you asked this question is that Mike Davis contacted Justice Unterhalter in an injunction needs to be imposed. That's factually incorrect. To clarify the matter, I specifically asked Mike Davis in my cross-examination of him. Mr. Davis, in his conversation with Justice Unterhalter, first of all, why did he call Justice Unterhalter? There's just be confusion surrounding that as well. Why did he call her? The tradition of the Judicial Council mandates that you go in order of hierarchy. The first person in command is Chief Justice Robert Gregg. Chief Justice Robert Gregg was asleep, his phone was off, and he had missed him in a number of hours. He was unavailable. He could not be reached. Who's second in command? Assistant Chair Jessica Unterhalter. It is in that spirit that Mike Davis contacted Jessica Unterhalter upon seeing the executive order. How do you see the executive order? Because it was sent to him. You'll also see in your evidence, a huge stack of evidence submitted by the defense. You'll also see in the evidence that President Leibovich's Executive Order No. 6 was sent to Mike Davis himself. It was not relayed to him by any other party. It was sent to Mike Davis himself. When Mr. Davis saw that, He got upset. He said, I'm going to sue you if you pass this EO. And being a former member of the judicial council, he thought, okay, irreparable harm, I'm going to sue. Chief Justice Craig was not available for contact. We contacted Jessica Unterhalter. But what was in that conversation, I specifically asked those questions to both Mike Davis as well as defendant Unterhalter. The extent of their conversation was, wake up, check your email, there's a charge sheet. My client tells me that she said, I want to sleep, go away. But Mr. Davis said, do your job, check your email, there's a charge sheet. That was the extent of the conversation. The reason I'm bringing this up is because there was not a conversation debating the merits of another emergency preliminary injunction. That was not what happened. Okay. The next thing that I want to bring up on that point is it's not even relevant, the fact that Mike Davis contacted Jessica Unterhalter. She passed emergency preliminary injunction completely consistent with the injunction passed by the judicial council initially. And it constituted irreparable harm, which I'm going to talk about in a second. But how he was able to contact her, he was a former member of the council. That's not relevant. And even if that is an important issue, but it's not an important issue to this hearing, in order to remove her, I've discussed Title 21 listing six possible things. That is not one of those six possible things. I do agree that's an issue, and I do agree that's important in democracy. But if you decide that's important, you cannot remove Justice Unterhalter from office on that basis. Perhaps the status quo should be changed. Perhaps the AOCC should turn within and ask questions and figure out how can we make members of the Judicial Council, how can we make members of the Senate, people always talk about the changes they want in the school, how can we make ourselves more accessible? That's a question to be asked independent of this hearing. But it's not something that Justice Unterhalter should receive the rap for. She cannot be impeached for that. I'd also like to turn your attention in terms of the contact and the interaction between Mr. Davis and Justice Unterhalter. The first page of the list of the packet of evidence you have from the defense is a signed statement by each and every member of the Judicial Council. The content of the signed statement says, I'm not going to reread it for you. You can read it on your own. But the contents of the signed statement states that every single member of the Judicial Council, if placed in the same exact position, would indeed have taken the same course of action. In other words, given the same 10-minute time frame, every single member of the Judicial Council has signed a statement indicating that they too would have issued an emergency preliminary injunction. Why would they have done that? Because it would have caused irreparable harm. Okay. The prosecution stated that he believes that the adequate reason burden was not reached when this emergency preliminary injunction was issued, and this constitutes grounds for failing to adhere to the JRP and thus grounds for removal from office. I'd like to take a second to discuss that. If you turn to your judicial rules of procedure, please read 3.8. 3.8 states that the council will issue a preliminary injunction when there is adequate reason to believe irreparable harm will be done before a formal hearing of the council. Such an order will preserve the status quo of the situation at the time of filing and shall be rescinded upon a decision of the council. If you turn to page 12 in your evidence, the pages aren't numbered, but I just counted them out. If you turn to page 12, you'll see the text of the injunction itself. Because I see that there's quite a bit of controversy surrounding irreparable harm. Okay. In order to impose an injunction, again, we just read 3.8, the council has to believe that there's adequate reason that irreparable harm will occur. Let's look at the irreparable harm, let's look at the reasoning of the judicial council so we can try to figure out what actually happened. In the second paragraph of the injunction itself in your evidence on page 12, the judicial council actually specifically addresses the issue of both irreparable harm that would have taken place. The defense acknowledges the fact that there is also irreparable harm from removing the referendum from the ballot. There's voter turnout issues. They didn't get to see it. Those have significant ramifications. The defense acknowledges that, and the defense is not okay with that. But the council addresses that in the text of their injunction. Turn to the second paragraph, and I'd like to read a quote for you. The Judicial Council recognizes that two forms of irreparable harm may be caused. First, if the ballots do include impartial referendum descriptions, student opinion of the initiative may be permanently tainted. However, if we prevent the referendum from appearing on the ballot, irreparable harm will be done to the Elections Council, who will have to hold a second round of voting of some form, which might result in lower voter turnout and additional expenditures. So the council is talking about the two forms of irreparable harm. The next sentence reads, upon weighing both points, the council believes the student voters' untainted opinion and the credibility of an ASC election to be more important. The council considered both forms of irreparable harm. They weighed it in. I know some of the senators are thinking, but what about the second form of irreparable harm? It's significant. You're absolutely right. It is significant. But they weighed both forms, and the council decided, whether or not anybody agrees with this or not, is not relevant. But the council decided, they issued an injunction saying, the former outweighs the latter. And in that spirit, an injunction was waived. And again, by the way, also submitted as evidence is a text of the decision itself, where they found the text of the referendum to be illegal. So when the executive order was issued by President Leibovich, contrary to that, that is why Justice Unterhalter, with the exact same reasoning in mind, issues an emergency preliminary injunction. Also on the issue of irreparable harm, also some senators have brought up some points as to Justice Unterhalter not having read the text of the executive order. This is a big issue, and I understand why this is being raised. According to the judicial rules of procedure, according to the process that is used, the actual text does not have to be read in full for this exact reason. This case actually proves exactly why you don't have to do that. If Justice Unterhalter had done that, if she had taken the time to read the entire text of the executive order, irreparable harm would have ensued because she only had 10 minutes to take action. She would not have had time to finish this in time. The referendum would not, the executive order would have continued. They would have stayed on the ballot, and the students' opinion, the students' thoughts about the referenda would have been permanently tainted. That's irreparable harm. That's what the council decided. There's also some arguments. As I read to you in Judicial Rules of Procedure 3.8, such an order, referring to a preliminary injunction, such an order will preserve the status quo of the situation at the time of filing and shall be rescinded upon a decision of the council. One of the senators brought up also, what about the new arguments brought up in the executive order? Legitimate question. Again, very legitimate question. However, the procedure in the Judicial Rules of Procedure is that any justice conditions an emergency preliminary injunction until the council can meet to consider such new arguments. That's precisely what Justice Unterhalter did. She did exactly what was reported to her in JRP 3.8 and 3.8.1. When the council met, they agreed. They did not rescind it. The entire council and bond had an opportunity to rescind the EPS, but they chose not to because they thought irreparable harm would have ensued. But what's the status quo? Certain arguments are floating around alleging that the status quo was changed by Justice Unterhalter's injunction. On the contrary, the status quo was upheld. The status quo was not for the referendum to be placed on the ballot. When the council originally got the case, as I read to you the quote from the text of the injunction, they weighed two forms of irreparable harm that would have ensued. They found the former to outweigh the latter, and they placed an injunction because they said irreparable harm would take place for the students because their opinions would be permanently tainted. So the status quo, that's right. So after they placed an injunction, the status quo was to keep the referendum off the ballot so that the process due in Title 4.10.3 to make sure that the text of referendum are impartial and accurate and accurately reflect the content of the referendum, to make sure that process is followed. The status quo, therefore, was that the students had not seen the referendum yet. The status quo was for it to be removed from the ballot. That was the status quo. President Leibovich's executive order attempted to overturn that, attempted to replace the referendum back on the ballot. But the status quo, remember, was not that they were on the ballot and that Justice Unterhalter removed them. The preliminary injunction that's not in dispute here was already placed, removing them from the ballot. So Justice Unterhalter's actions served to preserve the status quo of maintaining that, of avoiding that irreparable harm. On the issue of irreparable harm, I suppose now would be an appropriate time to have a discussion about disenfranchising voters, so that kind of links back to equal protection. If the students were presented with a referendum, but if the text of the referendum did not accurately reflect the content of the referendum, then that's an equivalent form of disenfranchising. That was the spirit behind the preliminary injunction, that was the spirit behind the emergency preliminary injunction, also imposed by Justice Unterhalter. I would like to also remind the Senate, the jurists, that due process is outlined in the JRP, the Judicial Rules of Procedure. The reason why I keep reading 3.8 and 3.8.1, and why I'm telling you what the burden is, the threshold of 5.1.2 of innocent until proven guilty, why do I keep saying this stuff? I'm saying this stuff because the JRPs are what we're bound to with Title 21, and also the Judicial Council is bound to follow. Whether or not one agrees with the actions taken, the process that is delineated in the JRP is what the council is bound by, and that's why they have to follow this process.
Sorry, are you talking about the witness?
The supervisor.
Oh, okay. Oh, this one.
On the note of equal protection also, my fellow book person is also reminding me to make one other point. As I was explaining to you, the equal protection of the students, the members of the association would have been violated had the EPI not been issued, because, again, their opinion would have been permanently tainted by inaccurate and partial language. If she had not issued the EPI, she would have violated equal protection in favor of President Leibovich. The Judicial Rules of Procedure state that the Judicial Council does not contact litigants, as we saw in testimony, before imposing an injunction. Why would the Judicial Council or Justice Unterhalter then contact President Leibovich before imposing an emergency preliminary injunction on his executive order? Because he's the president? That also violates equal protection. Okay, so in terms of the plateau of adequate reason, as 3.8 states, the council will issue a preliminary injunction when there's adequate reason to believe irreparable harm will be done. The burden is adequate reason. As the prosecution themselves concedes, the preliminary injunction is not an issue. The issue is not in question or in dispute. All that's in dispute is Justice Unterhalter's EPI, though the EPI is substantively equivalent to the actual injunction itself. In determining whether or not to accept the case, as you heard in testimony from Justice Unterhalter, one of the four criteria is whether or not the factual allegations constitute a violation.
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt one time. Okay, right now there's about three justices looking at the speaker. I will look up. Stretch your eye, look at the speaker. All senators? Cool, thank you. Okay.
Whether or not to oppose an injunction. An injunction is opposed at the time you accept the case. Those four criteria are whether or not the factual allegations determine a violation or not. There are arguments out there saying that Justice Unterhalter did not have a chance to read the body of the executive order prior to issuing the preliminary injunction, the emergency preliminary injunction. That is not a requirement. Justice Unterhalter is not required to have to read the entire text of the executive order. But what about new arguments, you might ask? New arguments are presented in the hearing itself. The injunction is meant to preserve the status quo, which it did, as I discussed. To preserve the status quo, the illegal referendum not being shown to the students. The injunction is meant to preserve the status quo until, in the case of an emergency preliminary injunction, until the entire council can meet, or in the case of just a preliminary injunction, until the hearing. At the hearing, new arguments are presented. But the entire body of the executive order does not have to be read. All Justice Unterhalter had to know about the executive order, which he was correct about, was that it reversed the effect of his initial injunction of taking the referendum off the ballot. That was what she knew, and she didn't just act off of that, off of a sentence at the bottom of the email saying good luck for the referendum and finding it back on the ballot. She also consulted the chair of the Elections Council, Angel Brewer, who would indicate to her that also it would also confirm the fact that an executive order had been issued putting the referendum back on the ballot. She acted completely in accordance with 3.8.1 in issuing the EPI. She could not. She also attempted to get a hold of Chair Gregg, and she was unable to do so, for the reasons I stated earlier. It was completely within the purview of her authority to issue the emergency preliminary injunction to, again, prevent irreparable harm from being placed on the students. So please, jurors, I encourage you, I want the jurors to understand what's important here. Do not consider whether or not the entire text of the executive order was read, because it doesn't have to be. In Judicial Review Procedure 3.6.2.2, I believe, it lists the four criteria of what needs, the four criteria that need to be met in order to accept a case and place an injunction. You do not have to know these. There's not enough time to read the entire text. That's precisely why it's written in there. If the factual allegations are correct, then you accept the case, and then you issue the injunction if necessary. So I'd like to get, I guess I don't have very much time left, but I'd just like to remind the entire Senate, the entire jurors, what's important and what's not. Availability of the council. Accessibility. This is an important issue to democracy, but it's not something that can be taken out on Justice Unterhalter for which she can be removed from office from. She cannot be removed from office from that. That's something the AHSC needs to work on independently. Davis did not have a conversation with Justice Unterhalter that influenced her decision on whether or not to issue an injunction. She issued the injunction because the EPI was the exact same as the original injunction that the council unanimously imposed earlier. Whether or not the jurors agree with the injunction being placed or not, whether or not the jurors agree, the injunction was nevertheless placed. The council found in the decision, in the case, that the text was indeed illegal. Thus, irreparable harm would have ensued. The injunction serves to preserve the status quo, to protect the equal protection, to protect the rights of the students not to be unduly swayed in one way or another. But why? What about disenfranchisement, you might ask? Why? Why? Because of due process. 4.10.3, Title 4 of the bylaws, states that the Attorney General must first look at a referendum before it goes to the Senate. It states that the language, the text of the referendum must be impartial, must be accurate. That's due process. That's in our law. And that's precisely why the council acted the way it did. Whether or not the jurists agree with that is not an issue here. What's the issue here is whether or not Justice Unterhalter failed to adhere with the rules of procedure in the judicial council. That's what's in Title 21. That's an impeachable offense. That's grounds for removal from office. Did she follow procedure? Completely and utterly. This is exactly what an emergency preliminary injunction was created for. When the council can't meet, like in the 10 minutes Justice Unterhalter has to act, a justice can issue it. That's what she did. It preserved the status quo, and the text was ultimately found to be illegal. Her actions were completely within her authority to do so, in accordance with the JRPs. They followed due process. They served to uphold the rights, the equal protection rights of students to not be unduly swayed, as delineated in Title 4. She followed her process. She stayed within the confines of her authority. And thus, there's no grounds for removal from office.
Thank you. Thank you. I like the motion for 5 minutes.
Okay. I'm going to step.
By issue a preliminary injunction. he did not pull out the card that says, I'm allowed to issue a verbal injunction. She realized at the time, because the president had made it so, that she had to issue that very injunction by email in contact with the rest of the Senate, with the rest of the executive, and the rest of everyone else that was located in the A2C. Now, the defense is going to make the argument that she still didn't have to reach that plateau because it's still not mentioned in 3.8.1. However, the defense counsel begs different. If the defendant makes new rights out of the JRP that did not exist beforehand or did not exist before the fact, what does that mean for the JRP document as a whole? What does that mean for the A2C Constitution, the A2C bylaws as a whole? That means that the justices of the Judicial Council could make up parts of the JRP that did not exist before or did not exist when they even exercised that right that did not exist before in the first place, and then argue later, after the fact, that it was a right that they had. I believe that it's setting a very, very bad precedent for the A2C. Not only allow them to exercise rights that previously did not exist before, but also letting them exercise that right with impunity. We are saying right now that I hereby issue a preliminary injunction. Those are the most four important words in this case right now. I hereby issue. Because if she did not issue a preliminary injunction before 9/11 a.m., when this email was sent out, she would not have been able to tell Elections Council, Angel,
objection. This is new information. This is a cross-examination of our argument. That's just
true. It's not a cross-examination of our argument. However, I respond to the argument that I'm not responding to adequate excuses, and that's why I'm responding to this argument before that we're getting previously, that the J Council shouldn't have to reach this plateau that was reached by the But you said something about verbal argument and the fact that it didn't I still want to close it, but you're throwing it in there right now.
So, what I'm responding to right now is the defense counsel's right to actually have the adequate reason at close of speech. And the defense counsel said earlier that there was no lack of due process. I mean, there was not a lack of violation of due process in the whole matter itself that occurred. And the prosecution counsel still believes that violation of due process still occurred in the fact that the rights of thousands of students were violated in not being able to vote on the referendum. When Edmund Michalinovich issued that executive order, he effectively put the referendum on the ballot and made that the new status quo. At that point, that was the new status of the organization, the A2C. After the fact, however, Jessica Wundswalter still decided to make an injunction against the executive order because she believed it to be illegal at the time. Now, the argument I'm trying to make as a prosecution is that this is all unnecessary, that it does not reach the adequate reason for irreparable harm to the A2C, and that's why I came here before you tonight saying that Jessica Wundswalter clearly was in malfeasance and dereliction of her duty as a J Council member. And I'll be saving all this rest of the good stuff for my closing statement. So yeah, I rest my case.
Thank you. I'm here. The justice or the counsel is a lot of time to ask questions only to the defendant, the defendant's witnesses, which means that you cannot ask your time. Mr.
Question for the officer. With your conversation with Ms. Brewer, I'm issuing a stay, or was it like a warning, or was it like an informative? Like, what was the nature of the conversation? Can you clarify?
Yeah, it was mostly, as I said, I realized how extremely, and I don't think anybody in the room can debate this, how extremely time sensitive, no matter what. And I told them, while in the process of taking, you know, maybe I hear that I already taken, I can survive, but for that matter, it was mostly, I am sending this, this is what it says. It's, you know, and so I guess informative in a few ways.
Quick call. So it was a warning and not a word.
No more follow-up questions, but that was a clarification. So, next, Mr. Cavanaugh.
Thank you.
they just do not enforce the insurance policy on their property. Yes, 10 minutes before that, he called her and he said, "We have one, and he said, we've got to do your job." To me, that sounds like you're interested. I do not receive the phone call from the police who have issued that injunction that you did.
As assistant chair, as we previously stated, I am second in line. Since Chair Greg was unavailable, he called me to tell me to make that vote. As assistant chair and as a member of this council, I have an obligation, both associations and students, to wake up and get up. But I apologize, but that wasn't a word where he was, adding to her flavor. As I say, I was obligated to work, to wake up. It was by the process. I had to get up then and look at the charge sheet. That was my obligation. That's what I agreed to do by becoming a member of the Eastern Council, to look at charges and to ask for the judicial procedure. So no, in no way can it work for me. I was already obligated to do so. He merely called because he had a charge sheet and he needed to get hold of a member of the council, and I happened to be a member of the council.
Okay.
Member of the line was unavailable. Yeah.
Let me also add on to that. The question you brought earlier. The reason I asked this, the reason why I said what I said, is because it seems to be implied, that Mr. Davis had undue access to the judicial council or whatever, and therefore they had a conversation debating the merits of whether or not the assumption should be imposed. That it was the spirit of answering that that I said what I said, namely that there was no influence. So there was no substantive influence. There was not a conversation that took place between Davis and Jeff Kuchenhalter saying, "My Davis saying, hey, put this injunction, Jeff is saying, okay." That did not take place. On the contrary, Jessica was one of the members that had examined the case, the original injunction hours before, and then she issued the same EPI later. But another aspect that is also, as I talked about in my case in chief, it's irrelevant how she found out. How she found out this issue aspect is not a question right now. As stated in Title 21, there are different ways to make this adjustment. So even if you're right, I have some issues with accessibility, and I definitely come to that. It's one of my big issues. I've already done it, definitely I'll take off. But that's something that's for a different form. This is an impeachment issue.
I've been
elaborate on a decision that